The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. This is our first program of 2025, and I hope all of you had really nice holidays and a great new year. We're going to start today's program with a story submitted by Linda Serlak, and it's titled Friday Nights at Turner's Hall. I grew up in Delran, a small southern New Jersey town that needed the help of two other towns to fill a high school. But that wouldn't be my school until I fulfilled a junior high rite of passage that made everyone feel awkward: the etiquette and ballroom dance class. Back in 1962 and 63, nobody asked us if we wanted to attend. Our parents banded together and made even the tough guys go. We were to learn proper manners and to gain enough confidence to feel at least somewhat comfortable when the number of our classmates increased greatly when we entered high school. At first, of course, we would only know the kids from our Delran Public School. Other students came from Riverside Public and the Catholic schools that encompass several towns. Willingly or not, we gathered on Friday nights at Turner's Hall for lessons with Mrs. Gregory, wearing our very best skirts or dresses. No slacks for girls. We sat with straight backs and knees together on folding chairs against one wall. It was girls on one side and boys across the room on the other. Those who were present still recall the scent of ivory soap that filled the gym because parents insisted their kids bathe before learning to slow dance. I'm sure that was a very good idea. My sister, who recalls those days too, reminded me that dance etiquette was stressed. The boy had to ask the girl politely to dance. "May I please have this dance?" Never say, "Can I?" Correct grammar was expected. If a girl turned a boy down, she couldn't accept the next boy's invitation. She had to sit that one out. After each dance, the boy would walk the girl back to her seat with a thank you. Girls were not allowed to ask boys to dance except for the occasional ladies' choice. Mrs. Gregory had a devious icebreaker that forced the boys to cross the room to the land of girls. First, she asked the girls to remove one shoe and place it in a pile in the center of the gym. Then the boys would choose a shoe and find the girl wearing the matching one. They became dance partners. It was nerve-wracking, wondering which fellow would claim my shoe. We learned the box step, the cha-cha, a popular line dance called the continental, and the twist. I can still hear Mrs. Gregory saying, "Take one foot forward and pretend you're rubbing out a cigarette butt with the ball of your foot. Now have the ball of your back foot rub out its own cigarette butt." The best part, though, was to pretend we were holding a bath towel. Then, with our arms out from our sides, we'd wipe the towel back and forth as if we were drying our backsides. Sam Cooke sang his 1961 hit song, "Twisting the Night Away," while we twisted and giggled away, too. The cha-cha, of course, was one of the most popular dances in the 1950s and early 60s. Sam Cooke even had a big hit with "Everybody Loves to Cha-Cha-Cha." It was a fun dance with so many ways to add to the basic steps. Happily, it was one dance where you didn't have to touch your partner if you didn't want to. And in junior high, there were lots of people you didn't want to touch. Everyone felt awkward back then. In retrospect, the Friday nights at Turner's Hall gave me the confidence to continue dancing the old-fashioned way. I still smile about those imaginary cigarette butts when I dance the twist at weddings. The next article I have for you is titled Copycat Sister, and it is written by Tony Boozer. Throughout most of my childhood, I felt compelled to copy whatever my big sister, Melanie, happened to be doing at the time. My earliest memory occurred in 1960 when we were living in Fairbanks, Alaska. My sister ice skated, and therefore I wanted to. Mom bundled me up and strapped pink double runner skates on my feet. I kept falling down and became a human popsicle, not to mention my sore behind. I sat down and pouted, ready to go home. Melanie, always a trooper, kept right on skating. In my eyes, Melanie did everything to perfection. I, on the other hand, somehow managed to flub everything I tried. At least it seemed that way to me. I was amazed by Melanie's drawings. While most children her age scrawled crude stick figures, Melanie, when barely in grammar school, was effortlessly sketching beautifully detailed people, nature, and animals. She took great pride in using her art skills to fashion unique greeting cards for our parents. It was her way of showing them love and appreciation. I tried to follow in her footsteps, but the results came out more like bizarre abstract paintings. Although she was only 2.5 years older, Melanie seemed more like an adult than a child to me. She was thoughtful and introspective and rarely got into trouble for doing anything bad. She was a perfectionist, earning good grades in school. If she ever happened to achieve anything less than an A, she was devastated. On her report cards, she received glowing comments from teachers. I, on the other hand, was the complete opposite. Although I wanted to do well in school like my sister, I just didn't have it in me. My report card would usually read, "Tony daydreams constantly and doesn't complete her work." Melanie was very conscientious of using correct behavior in public, even at the tender age of 6. Once, after Mom dropped us both off at a movie matinee in El Paso, Texas, I was the tag-along sister once again. Melanie was dismayed when, fascinated by the wide center aisle in the theater, I suddenly bolted, tearing down the aisle like a jet airplane preparing for takeoff. When our mother picked us up after the movie, she found Melanie traumatized and humiliated by the incident, mournfully crying over and over again. She reflected on me. Evidently, my sister had taken a lesson learned in Sunday school a little too close to heart. My mother brought this funny story up many times over the years, and it always made us laugh. While living in Montgomery, Alabama in 1967, Melanie came home one day with a fab new Twiggy haircut. I begged Mom to take me to the beauty shop so I could get one too. We became the Twiggy sisters. That is, until our hair grew back out again. At this time, Melanie owned a fabulous collection of 45 RPM records featuring artists such as the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Paul Revere and the Raiders, and the Loving Spoonful. I, the die-hard copycat, diligently scourged up pennies, dimes, and nickels, some found under couch cushions, and purchased my own 45s. I'm sure my sister grew weary of the shadow following her every move. However, when Melanie got her ears pierced, I didn't copy that. Having needles poked through my earlobes was too scary for me to even think about. While residing at Patch Barracks Army Base in Stuttgart, Germany from 1968 to 1970, Melanie grew into a really hip teen. She wore out-of-sight go-go boots and miniskirts, form-fitting blouses and sweaters, and the grooviest fishnet stockings. She painted her nails with glitter polish and slathered on frosted lipstick. Unfortunately, at this point, I was the epitome of the awkward age. Oh, how I longed to wear fishnet stockings and beautify myself with sparkly nail polish and bubblegum lipstick like Melanie. But alas, I was merely a gawky little kid who couldn't look grown up if my life depended on it. When Melanie got a boyfriend, I tried to tag along, but they shooed me off like a pesky bug. Melanie and Tim had tons of fun entering dance contests, performing the popular moves of the day, such as the jerk, the swim, and the pony. I wanted to have fun, too, but I was told I was too young. Not only could Melanie dance, she played the guitar and sometimes gave lessons to other tenants residing at Patch Barracks. In 1969, I asked for and received a guitar for Christmas. I played it badly for a short time until the guitar ended up forgotten in the back of the closet. When Tim presented his sweetheart Melanie with a fancy cellophane-wrapped, heart-shaped gingerbread cookie for Valentine's Day, she put it in her dresser drawer for safekeeping, or so she thought. The cookie sat uneaten in the drawer for 2 weeks until temptation got the better of me. One day, while Melanie was out on one of her excursions with Tim, I unwrapped the cookie, took a couple of bites, rewrapped it, and returned it to the drawer. I repeated this process several times over the next few days. Why Melanie never confronted me about her disappearing cookie, I'll never know. I'm sure she didn't think a little mouse ate it. I grew up wearing Melanie's cast-off hand-me-down clothes, lovingly sewn by our mother Ruth. But as I got older and was allowed to choose my own clothes, I slowly became my own person. I even took special delight in choosing several cute outfits for myself from the Sears catalog. I also began developing my own interest, such as ballet, even though Melanie quit ballet lessons after a year. It made me realize I could do something on my own, and I stopped copying my sister so much. I'm certain Melanie breathed a huge sigh of relief. And the next story I have for you is submitted by Shane Kays, and it's titled School Jeans. As a chunky little 8-year-old whippersnapper in 1965, living in Bowling Green, Missouri, there was always one day in early fall that I dreaded. About 2 weeks before school started, Mom would give me the word, "We're going shopping for school jeans tomorrow." Now, small rural towns of Missouri were never known as fashion centers, but we did have a TV. It was only black and white with 3 channels, 1 out of Hannibal and 2 out of Quincy, Illinois. But it was TV, so we knew there were cool clothes out there in the real world. Our small town did have a nice little clothier on the west side of the square called P.N. Hirsch that stocked a limited offering of cool clothes for boys. But Mom insisted on those industrial quality jeans that could only be found at the local farm and home store. Ours was Orchland Farm and Home Supply, right there on Highway 61, midway through town. Yours might have had a different name, but they were all the same. As soon as you walked in the door and stepped on the gray painted concrete floor, there was that farm and home store smell, tractor tires, and pesticide. Each year, I had high hopes that this year would be different. So as we neared the boys' wear section, I stopped at a rack that held new, light blue, super smooth, soft, classic cut jeans. But as I had a profound love of penny candy and mashed potatoes and white gravy, Mom yanked me over to the Husky jeans section, also known as Dorkville. Thus, my dreams were smashed again. It was a well-known fact that there were never any cool jeans in the Husky section. About that time, an old man, chomping on a cigar, came out from behind a curtain in the back. He was wearing a red Massey Ferguson hat, a green plaid flannel shirt, blue dress pants pulled up over his navel, and one of those cloth tape measures slung over his shoulder like Pancho Villa's bullet belt when he was invading a small Texas border town. Oh, great, I thought. This old codger's going to give me fashion advice. Well, looks like we got some measuring to do here, he said as he patted me on the head. He leaned down with the tape measure, and then it hit me. Holy cow, this old coot smells like aqua velva-covered mold. I knew my mom would clock me if I said something, so I just held my breath and smiled a lot. I asked, "You got any of those cool, light blue, super smooth jeans in my size?" "Nah, not in your size, Sonny," he replied as he reached into the Husky rack. "Here, Mom, try these on the young fella." Mom unfolded the jeans, and they were so stiff that they actually popped and crackled. Then he gave Mom his surefire salesman line. "That's some good material there. He won't be a bustin' out of them any time soon." After three attempts, I was finally lowered into those sleeves of steel. They were so stiff I couldn't bend my legs, and so rough I was sure I would light my thighs on fire if I tried to run. They were 4 inches too long and 2 inches too big around the waist. "Perfect fit," said Mom. "We'll just cuff the bottom and buy a belt." Old moldy Grandpa chimed in, too. "He won't be a-growing out of them any time soon." "Heck no, I didn't grow out of them until I was in high school, and the warranty was still good on that horsehide material they were made of." Then I got more good news. Mom said, "Great, we'll take 5 pairs. Gee whiz, I'm never going to be able to run again. So wearing one of 5 new pairs of jeans I was stuck with, I went out of the store and I waddled to the back of the station wagon where I laid myself out like a piece of plywood for the ride home. No matter how hard I tried not to, I had to wear a pair of those Kevlar-coated dual tubes of doom to the first day of school. So there I was on the first day, all the other kids sitting cross-legged on the gym floor while I was propped up over in a corner like an American flag on a stand, unable to bend at the knees. You know, it's kind of hard on a husky young fellow to be the cool one in class when he has to gimp stiff-legged down the halls in rigid midnight blue jeans with an oversized cowboy belt, a 4-inch cuff, and little horse appliques sewn onto his back pockets. From the Good Old Days on Wheels section, Lowell Holmgren submits a story titled My Love of Motorcycles. In 1943, I was 12 years old and World War II was well underway. Gasoline and most everything else was rationed. My father was very patriotic. To cut down on gasoline use, he bought a Cushman motor scooter. It got about 60 miles per gallon. His Buick only got 12. I was in the driveway the day the scooter was delivered, and I thought it was the most beautiful machine I had ever seen. My father was a businessman and always wore a 3-piece suit with a white shirt and tie. The next morning after the scooter was delivered, I watched him ride off to work on it, wishing it was me riding that wonderful machine. That afternoon when he came home, I was right there waiting for him. He parked the scooter, got off, and backed away from it. He looked at it and then turned to me and said, "From now on, that thing belongs to you." And he went into the house. I was thunderstruck, speechless with joy. I never found out what had happened to him, and I didn't care. I rode that thing for about 3 years, to school, to scout meetings, delivering papers, etc. I loved every minute and mile. Then one day, I apparently did something wrong, and Dad took it away from me. I never saw it again. I had a nice Schwinn bicycle. I took it to a machine shop and had a flat steel plate welded to the frame just above the pedal hub. I bolted a 1-horsepower Briggs & Stratton engine on the plate, hooked it up to the back wheel with V-belt, pulleys, sprockets, and chain, and I had a motorbike. It had direct drive, and I had to push it to start it. When the engine fired, I jumped on and away I went. It had a top speed of about 25 miles an hour. 4 or 5 of my friends had similar machines, and we made quite a gang, charging around and bending the rules of the road. We never got stopped for speeding. We couldn't go that fast. There were 2 city police officers, Felbert Mann and Ralph Retz, who gently kept us within due bounds. I rode that bike to high school, 2 miles each way in all kinds of weather. When there was snow and ice on the streets, I took an occasional spill, but nothing serious. One summer day, my friend Ed and I were riding around the streets near home, and I was showing off my great skill by riding with my feet cocked up on the crash bars, hands clasped over my knees, no hands on the handlebars. Ed pulled up beside me and accidentally touched my left handlebar. That jerked the front wheel, threw me off balance, and suddenly I was sitting in the same position on the street while the bike had righted itself and was proceeding down the street without me. Now, I was not only sitting there, I was sliding at about 15 miles an hour, and the pavement was not smooth like glass. Very quickly, the seat of my jeans and the seat of my undershorts were gone, and I was sliding down the street on my bare rear end. Ed came back and helped me up and walked me home about 3 blocks. I was in some pain, and my rear was a bloody mess. I lay across the closed toilet seat while Ed washed and applied half the can of Band-Aids to my injuries. In the meantime, my bike had traveled half a block down the road and angled off through the ditch into a building site where a hole had been dug for a basement. You guessed it, that's where the bike went. We found it there and dragged it up and out. Fortunately, it was not hurt nearly so badly as I was. A few years later, I had a part-time job. I was feeling flush with cash and decided I wanted to move up in the world. So I bought a new Royal Enfield 125cc motorcycle. It had a 1-cylinder, 2-cycle gas engine that required me to add a measure of 60-weight motor oil to every tank of gas. I enjoyed riding that bike, but didn't take very good care of it, and after a couple of years, the engine blew and it disappeared. Then, for some unknown reason, I shifted to automobiles. That led to girls, and that led to marriage. We got very busy building a house and raising a family. We had 5 fantastic children, 4 of whom survived and have blessed me with grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We divorced after 24 years. During all those times, I had no motorcycles. Eventually, I remarried, and it turned out my second wife, Dee, enjoyed riding motorcycles as a passenger behind me. So I got a 1983 Honda 800. It had a 4-cylinder, fluid drive, and no clutch. We enjoyed riding that bike, but it was not a long-distance highway bike. After a few years, I bought my first Goldwing. I believe it was a 1993 1100cc 4-cylinder. It had nice padded bucket seats. Now we could enjoy riding farther afield. We found that the Black Hills of western South Dakota are ideal. There are hundreds of miles of winding roads through pine-clad hills. We spent many weekend days exploring all those byways. After a while, I got itchy feet again. I traded those two bikes for a newer Goldwing. This baby was the Cadillac of motorcycles. Six-cylinder, 1300cc, five-speed transmission, electric starter, cruise control, AM, FM radio, CB radio, stereo speakers on the dash, and earphones and microphones in the helmets. Not to mention, it had very comfortable bucket seats. We rode that machine all over the country, Seattle, Denver, Minneapolis, Duluth, and many places in between. We belonged to several fraternal groups and attended state and national conventions. After many years of enjoyment, in my late 70s, I finally hung up my helmet and quit riding. My son got the Goldwing. Now I am 93 and I don't drive or even own any kind of a motor vehicle. My short-term memory can be a bit spotty, but my head is chock full of wonderful memories of the good old days. I want to share with you a famous quote by Tecumseh, who was a Native American chief of the Shawnee. And he said, "When you rise in the morning, give thanks for the light, for your life, for your strength. Give thanks for your food and the joy of living. If you see no reason to give thanks, the fault lies in yourself." We're going to go back to the 1950s, and can you tell me what sport these sports stars played? Rocky Marciano. He was a boxer. Earl Lloyd. He played basketball. Sam Snead. He was a golfer. Maureen Connolly. She played tennis. Otto Graham. He played football. And last, Willie Mays. And he was a baseball player. And did you know, on January 15, 1967, the first Super Bowl championship game was held? We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it, and I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.